This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Increasingly, these decisions and these huge, huge debates for our future are being held in state capitals, and people aren't still paying enough attention to the people who are making those decisions, how they got there, who they're beholden to, what their point of views are, and the fact that a sad number of them are simply not telling the truth about key things that are happening in this country.
There are forces in the U.S. that like to selectively bring up states' rights from time to time. With the impending decision stripping the federal protections for access to safe abortion, this is one of those times. But most of us don't methodically monitor what happens in states that are not our own. Wouldn't it be nice if there were a single source where one could find reliable reporting on state-level politics and policies? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to the founder and publisher of the state's newsroom, Chris Fitzsimon. We discuss the business model for this nonprofit news outlet, the landscape of the online news industry, and why it's more vital than ever to deliver readers truthful, well-presented local news. Then we revisit part of last year's discussion with Liz King, the Director of Education at the Leadership Council on Civil and Human Rights, as she outlines the battle over civil rights in our nation's public schools. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Chris Fitzsimon. He is the founder and publisher of the state's newsroom. Chris, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I bet a lot of our listeners have read pieces that have gone through the state's newsroom network, but haven't even been aware of it. Why don't you explain your organization's model and why you decided there was a need for what you do?
Well, I think we are founded on a fairly simple principle, and that is that the level of government that is has the most effect on people's lives and is covered the less, if you combine those two things, is state government. A lot of people always want to, and I do too, I'm very interested in what's happening in Congress and the White House and the Supreme Court, especially recently. But for the most part, most Americans' daily lives are impacted more by what happens in their state than any other level of government. And that has been happening while the number of people who cover that has been dramatically shrinking over the last decade as the national media has undergone its contraction. That's a lot of times the first place people cut, the legacy newspapers cut. So we exist to help fill that void and to try to step into capitals where the press corps has shrunk by 50, 60, even 80% over the last decade, and provide some daily reporting and some analysis and enterprise reporting and commentary about what's happening in state capitals. We've been around since 2017. We've been an independent national nonprofit since 2019. We just launched our 26th outlet in Nebraska in January. May 11th, the Alaska Beacon will launch and become the 27th outlet. We have a Washington Bureau. We have a national site. Another big point I want to make is that a lot of decisions that are made in your state capital, wherever you're listening to this today, are not in a vacuum. There are similar bills and issues that come up in every state capital across the country. So we have a national site, newsfromthestates.com, which lets you see all of those in one place. You can search for voting rights, you can search for climate change, and you can see all those stories from capitals around the country, and you'll quickly realize that it's not an accident that they're taking up the same things, often regressive legislation that is a model sent to legislators by various places. And we also have a national newsletter to try to sort of synthesize that for people. So it's all built around giving people more information to make decisions about their lives about a place we think has the most impact, which is state capitals.
And does your relationship with these states' newsrooms, for lack of a better term, within the states' newsroom model, does it vary greatly, or is it is your relationship similar with all of these organizations? Have some of the papers already existed and they've kind of used you as a distribution outlet, et cetera?
The vast majority are outlets that we started. We visited state capitals, got to know people, talked to advocates and media folks, and then hired well-respected journalists to run them. So we have 23 now of those. We'll soon have 24. We do have three partner outlets, we call them, one of which is NC Policy Watch, where I used to work. One is the Maine Beacon, and one is Maryland Matters. They did previously exist. And I think that probably will change. Some of those might actually come on board, depending on how everything goes in the next couple years. But the vast majority of our outlets are ones that we started, and they work for us. They are supervised by national editors here. All their digital support and all those things are handled in a central office. The Washington Bureau works for them as well. So it's all, the idea is we try to centralize a lot of the back end things and some of the supervision, so the people in the states can do the journalism and tell their audiences what's important and what the information they need to know, and work with communities to find out what they need to know as well.
So you talk about the journalists in these various states. The 26, 27 states that you mentioned, you're not covering Albany, Sacramento, some of the bigger states in terms of your low-hanging fruit. Is that fair to say?
It is at this point. I'm not sure what the future will hold, but we do have, I mentioned the News from the States site, which we run, that has all of our content constantly fed and has curated stories, but we have just signed an agreement with the Texas Tribune, for example, so their content will be there. So there'll be some other states that we don't run on that particular site, but right, we're not in Sacramento, we're not in Austin, we're not in Albany at this point.
And what kind of journalistic standards are you able to apply, or do you want to espouse for your network of sites, Chris?
Well, I think we do the best job we can to cover what's important, and we try to let people in the states tell us what that is, communities in the states and people that have issues and needs and ideas about their lives, and our journalists are very responsive to them. We do have ethic guidelines. We abide by journalism practices. That's a weird phrase, I guess, these days. We don't cover everything the same. We don't treat every side the same. We don't print things that are patently false. Or if we do print something that a politician says that is false, we point out that it's false. I think we're trying to do, as journalism is evolving, we're trying to be part of that evolution and tell people the information they need to know, not merely be stenographers, but be analysts as well, and try to include as many community voices as we can in that process. And we do have commentary, which is, I guess, been described as left of center. I'll leave it to other people to label it, but we try to write about state and local issues. Our editors do, and we have a lot of guest commentaries from members of the community. So interestingly, a lot of legacy papers are shying away now from commentary, and we think it's an important part of the journalism landscape.
I just noticed that the New York Times hired a new editor-in-chief, Joe Kahn, who his first statement was a little troubling in that it kind of talked about how the Times has an obligation to cover both sides, and that is almost a flashpoint term for a lot of people following the media, is both sidesism. You mentioned how you're not going to be allowing your network organizations to be publishing things that are patently false, but it must be a tricky dance when there is so much misinformation out there. What are your thoughts on the Kahn hiring, and how does a publisher decide what is wheat and what is chaff?
Well, that's the question. I guess the Kahn hiring, I also maybe took a pause when I read that, but we'll have to see how that plays out into the news pages of the New York Times. You know, the irony, of course, is that the New York Times is assailed all the time as being on one side by the conservatives. At the same time, a lot of us are worried that they do cover both sides not as critically as they should. The dilemma, I think, for journalists is it is news when a politician who's elected to represent tens of thousands in a state or hundreds of thousands of people in a state says things that are patently false. That's a news story that someone who is representing people is saying things that are simply not true. But the obligation is to point out that it's not true and to put those things in context so people have information. We can't ignore the fact that we have elected officials who are lying about, well, the last election is the most obvious example. So we have to cover that and try to explain it. And I think that we're increasingly, as I mentioned in the very first answer to the very first question, increasingly these decisions and these huge, huge debates for our future are being held in state capitals, and people aren't still paying enough attention to the people who are making those decisions, how they got there, who they're beholden to, what their point of views are, and the fact that a sad number of them are simply not telling the truth about key things that are happening in this country.
Fancy Dan, gambling man, top hat of the peanut man, talking about your pot of gold, the silver liner. Tumbling dice, hit it twice, boats and the flushes, they sure look nice on a pot of gold, the silver liner. Stay the line, give you hard times, stay too long. Goodbye, pretty women, I ain't staying on. Come on, get a hunch, better a bunch. Come to gamble, better pack at lunch. For a pot of gold, sell the line.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Chris Fitzsimon. He is the founder and publisher of The States Newsroom. So, Chris, you mentioned how you started The States Newsroom in 2017, and it became a nonprofit 2 years later. Why don't you expand, if you can, on the challenges of being a nonprofit news organization and maybe some of the benefits as well?
Yeah, well, the challenges, of course, is that we don't have access to the resources, obviously, that a legacy media outlet would have. But I think there's no question that nonprofits and philanthropy and is going to play a significant role in journalism going forward. One of the things that is freeing for a lot of our journalists and editors is that we don't judge the success of a story by the number of clicks. We want people to read the stories. We don't do stories simply to get readers. We monitor our audience, and we want it. But if there's a really important story, we do it. And if a lot of people don't read it, we feel like we have to figure out other ways to get it in front of people and promote it and share it and try to create a buzz around it because we think it's important. So I think the advantage is we're not beholden to turning a profit at the end of the day. And the biggest advantage, I think, by far, is that we make our coverage and our content free to everyone. We have a republishing tool that's very easy that we developed, our digital team developed, and in an average month, we'll probably have 4,000 to 5,000 stories reprinted across the country in small papers that have no way to afford coverage. They can't afford Associated Press. They can't send someone to the Capitol, certainly a reporter. So a small town in Iowa now, I always think of that, I use that paper as an example, has state coverage for the first time in 10 years probably, because they carry our coverage about what's happening in Des Moines. But interestingly, the Des Moines Register also runs our stories because their workforce has been slashed so much that they can't cover the news either. So we're just trying to fill that void as best we can. But I think the biggest advantage of a nonprofit is we not only are allowed, we allow people to publish. We have an obligation to allow people, I think, because we're a public good now as a nonprofit, and we try to serve the community that way.
Maybe you can recap, because I'm not really as familiar as I imagine you are, of some of the efforts on the for-profit news side of things over the last couple decades to take advantage of a fragmented industry that's kind of been kind of regrouping as the age of the internet and consumers expect to read everything for free, that new reality. I'm thinking of, like, I know Sheldon Adelson's group has bought up a lot of small papers. How have those efforts not only worked from a business standpoint, but affected journalism on a state's level in general?
Yeah, well, in general, there are waves of layoffs still happening in the journalism industry, in the legacy media outlets. There are waves of layoffs, and there are takeover bids, and there are legacy newspapers with wonderful histories, or storied histories, I should say, who are now owned by a hedge fund whose goal is to maximize profit, is to shrink the workforce, is to reduce the number of people who actually do the journalism and sort of benefit as much as they can off the brand and then, you know, move in another direction. So it's very alarming. And we have, I have lots of friends that's still at legacy newspapers, and it is it's a constant struggle and battle for them to do their jobs. I still encourage people to support, to subscribe to those papers, to do the best they can to support them. But it is very difficult for a lot of journalists around the country. And, you know, we have people who in states that we're not in who will write us and say, are you coming to our state? Because we don't have enough people covering it. We want to work at a place that, that we can feel good about and secure in. So, you know, I always tell people, I don't know what the future of journalism is. We might all be receiving news in our head, in a chip in our forehead in 20 years. But I know that as we get to that place, we can't wait for the perfect model, and philanthropy and public support of nonprofit journalism has to play and will continue to play a key role, I think, in trying to keep democracy alive, which we used to take for granted. I'm not so sure we can anymore.
And are all of your publications digital only, or are there some in print?
They are digital. They are digital only. I'm not sure what the future will hold there, but they are at this point all digital.
And maybe you can kind of give us a glimpse into what your headcount is and your budget and your funding plans. And maybe if you're allowed to kind of give us an idea of where the bulk of your funding comes from, Chris.
Yeah, well, when we were trying to decide what we should do about talking about our funding, we looked at that. There's a group called Chalkbeat, which is a national education organization, and some people like them, some people don't. I think they have really good reporters there. They're in a series of states, so we sort of established their model, and everybody that's given us $500 or more is listed on our website. So they're big donors, small donors, and everybody in between. So we get foundation support. We get a lot of reader support. And what we try to do is go to a state with enough to pay for a small staff, and then in almost every state we've received enough support to increase our reach with additional staff people or additional freelancers. Every state that we start has an editor and three reporters, so we have four full-time journalists, which doesn't sound like much, but in some states that makes us one of the larger folks at the state capitol. And all those, unlike a lot of nonprofits, and again, I applaud, we work across the country with a lot of folks in partnerships, but those journalists don't have to do much except report and edit and write and speak and get to know people and get to know the community, because we have we do a lot of almost all their support is done by folks either here in North Carolina or in Washington. So that the model really is we want the people in the states to do the journalism.
So do you have a big enough footprint to be able to set aside environmental reporting as a subset and climate change as a main focus? Why don't you kind of give us an idea of where you're hoping to delve into the green side of journalism?
Yeah, thank you for the question. We certainly cover the environment in every state because climate change and environmental issues are so important to our future, but also the quality of life that we have now. We have one of the best environmental reporters in the country at North Carolina Policy Watch, who I think has won virtually every award you can win, Lisa Sorg. We have dedicated environmental reporters in several states. We have one in Virginia that's funded by the Oak Hill Foundation in Virginia. We have other contributors in various states. We would love to expand and have full-time climate or environmental reporters in all of our outlets, and some we're able to and some we're not. So that is definitely something we would love to do in the future. And a lot of people that give us money, and we have, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of individuals who give us money, mention climate and the environment often. So we're constantly trying to figure out how we're going to expand that. We're working on, and I think you'll see more regional projects from our states that have things in common, whether it's in the Southwest or the Northeast. We've been working with we may have an environmental project with some nonprofits in Louisiana. So we're constantly trying to do what we can to give people the information they need.
And how do people know that they're on a state's newsroom site, and maybe give them some calls to action when they come across your content and they're impressed enough to want to become regular readers?
Yeah, well, there every news, first of all, every outlet, if you go to the New Hampshire Bulletin, if you just click about the New Hampshire, you want to find out if you think this is a good website, you go to the New Hampshire Bulletin, it'll tell you that you're on that New Hampshire Bulletin is part of the state's newsroom network. Every outlet has its own daily newsletter that's delivered in the morning, as does News from the States, our national site. So you can sign up. The newsletters are all free. Every newsletter also has a place, and every website has a place where you can donate, even if it's, you know, $10 or $100 or whatever you're able to give. That would be great. We do count on reader support for expanding our coverage and making sure we continue to cover the things that that people need to know in each state capital and across the country.
The organization is the State's Newsroom. He's the publisher and founder, Chris Fitzsimon. Chris, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I've got news for you, baby. Things ain't like they used to be. I've got news for you, baby. Things ain't like they used to be. I'm cutting out on you, darling, going back to the old time used to be. Now I thought I was your lover, but I was just your little fool. I thought I was your lover, but I'm just your little fool. And you taught me a lot of things that I never learned in school.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Liz King. Liz is the Senior Director of the Education Equity Program at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Liz, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to engage.
So you want to double the budget for the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. What does that mean logistically? What is like the current budget, and what would doubling it mean, not only in terms of a dollar number, but in terms of just looking at all the complexities from a political standpoint?
Sure. So thinking about both the technical aspect of federal funding and then going to the political implications, last year, the Office for Civil Rights received $131 million. President Biden has requested that that be increased to $144 million, which is important. You know, we appreciate that President Biden has recognized that additional funding for civil rights enforcement is an important part of any agenda that describes itself as supporting racial equity or LGBTQ equity or gender justice. We are asking for $260 million for the Office for Civil Rights, given the context of the COVID-19 public health crisis and its serious detrimental effects on educational equity, given the DeVos agenda of discrimination and exclusion we've seen for the last 4 years, and given, frankly, the significant challenges too many students were facing even before the Trump inauguration to accessing an equal educational opportunity. We think that now is the time, in the context of a long overdue racial reckoning, in the context of very clear demands from students and their families that we attend to the ways in which they experience discrimination and marginalization, now is the time to robustly invest in the critical functions of the Office for Civil Rights, in the everyday experience of students, and the way in which every student deserves an opportunity to submit a complaint of discrimination when they experience discrimination in their school and have the Office for Civil Rights ready to respond, to provide them support in the context of that complaint, to intervene when there is discrimination. And most importantly, the Office for Civil Rights needs the resources to prevent discrimination in the first place, to provide technical assistance to schools, school districts, to educators who reach out and ask for advice and guidance about how to provide an education free from discrimination. We need data. We need the civil rights data collection and the data it provides about every public school in the United States and the educational opportunity being provided to those students. So these critical functions of the Office for Civil Rights play an incredibly important role in educational opportunity for students, which we know is determinative of the future of our country. And now is the time to meaningfully invest and ensure the Office for Civil Rights has the resources that it needs.
Liz, maybe you can put into context what it means for children of color to be put out of school in the kind of rates that we've seen across the country and how that ends up feeding other concerns all through society, namely the school-to-prison pipeline.
In this country, we have a deeply discriminatory system of school discipline that is resulting in the exclusion and criminalization of Black children, Native American children, other children of color, children with disabilities, and in many instances, most especially children of color with disabilities. LGBTQ students are finding themselves disproportionately excluded from school as a result of discipline policies and practices. Thankfully, the Office for Civil Rights in the Obama administration finally took meaningful action to make plain and clear that racial discrimination in the context of school discipline was unlawful under our civil rights laws. But we know this is not just an esoteric concept around compliance with a law or data collection. We know this has a real effect in the everyday experience of children. We have all been reminded in the COVID-19 crisis what the real consequences are when a child misses a day of school or more. We see children being pushed out of school on the basis of school discipline for days and weeks and months at a time. We cannot afford for children to lose even a single hour of instruction, let alone the implications of a racially disproportionate and an unjust, ableist system of school discipline. Educators want and deserve support to provide an education free from discrimination, and that includes in the context of school discipline. Thankfully, there has been amazing leadership by youth in this country to demand that their schools become safe, welcoming, and inclusive places for them to learn, grow, and thrive. We have seen in the past the Office for Civil Rights show leadership and demonstrate its responsibility to ensure that our laws are being followed and that children have access to an education free from discrimination. When a child is suspended out of school, it can have significant consequences for them. It can have academic consequences when they lose instruction. There can be risks to their safety and well-being if there is not a safe place for them to be when they're not in school. And we know definitively from repeated research what common sense would tell us, which is that suspending or expelling a child puts them on a very dangerous trajectory to a very difficult life circumstance. We have a responsibility to ensure that all schools are safe, welcoming, and inclusive for all children. The Office for Civil Rights has a specific responsibility in that, as does every child and parent and educator in this country. We need to make sure the Office for Civil Rights has the resources it needs so that every child can attend school free from discrimination, including in the context of school discipline.
She's the Senior Director of the Education Equity Program at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, Liz King. Liz, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Fog Swamp, Steven Stills, and T-Bone Walker.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.